I'm Nicholas Jones, and during the miners' strike of 1984-5, I was the full-time labour and industrial correspondent for BBC Radio 4. And that decade of the 80s was the most momentous decade to be a labour and industrial correspondent because, of course, it was the decade of all of those strikes that had Mrs. Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher, pitched and pitted against the trade unions as she began to break up the nationalised industries. And my word, it was a decade to remember.
Nick, can you give us a couple of instances which really stick out in your mind about your coverage over the 80s?
What I think so significant for me, we're now in the middle of this 40th anniversary, and the airwaves have really been given over to the miners, to the strikers themselves. And there have been lots of archive programmes where we've looked back and seen young miners in their 20s and 30s, and now we're seeing them in their 60s and 70s. And really, they're getting their right of reply. And I think it has been very sobering for the journalists like myself who covered the strike, because, of course, we, in many people's eyes, especially in the mining communities, we're not viewed with any favour at all. And looking back, I would have to agree that there's no doubt about it. I was a radio reporter, and the whole, I think, of the mainstream media was sort of swept along behind the government's agenda. And I think it is a worrying time, you know, to be a journalist when there's a great sort of government push and all of the forces of the state are sort of brought together. And the broadcasters, we got swept along. Where did we go wrong? Where we went wrong, I think, was that perhaps we spent far too much time on the return to work. Mrs. Thatcher wanted to get half the miners back at work, and she eventually claimed she had. And we didn't spend enough time looking at the plight of the mining communities.
Okay, well, I'd like to pick your brains a little bit, but there must have been some moments where events were unfolding in an unexpected way and it really challenged your ability to do your job.
Yes, undoubtedly. I felt that there was no doubt about it that the coal board was trying to massage the figures of the return to work. And I did stand out at one point, and I did manage to get a probing piece on air, but it only had one outing. And I felt that there was no doubt about it that the forces of the sort of responsibility, if you can call it like that, back in the government made it very difficult, I think, to challenge what was happening. Another very momentous moment was in the middle of the strike, just after Orgreave. I did do Arthur Scargill a favour because his driver was going off with his wife. It was their wedding anniversary. He asked me, he said, Nick, he said, would you mind driving Arthur back to town tonight? And that was a 4-hour drive from Llandudno in North Wales down to Scargill's flat in the Barbican. And I can tell you, as a journalist, it was quite a moment to be talking to Arthur for 4 hours.
Well, I think we're very lucky that he's still alive. What do you make of him as a
86.
character? Yeah.
What do I make of him? Well, I think what's coming through, Tony, is that there's no doubt about it that, and you hear this now in the reflections of so many of the men, I think they are saying these people who spent, you know, so much of their life on strike that year, they are beginning to sort of question the tactic, whether the all-out tactic of continuing the all-out strike was correct, and whether perhaps the union should have found some way in the summer of 1984, that was 6 months into the strike, of trying to find a negotiated settlement, to have been more
Yeah,
pragmatic.
but don't you think it's a little bit like Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn? It's being undermined from within as well.
Yes, undoubtedly. But one had to acknowledge the reality of the position. The reality of the position is that the blue line, the police, had got control of the situation, and it was just going to be a question of time until the miners were starved back to work, which they were. And some pragmatic trade unionists, you've only got to go out and talk to them, and now saying, well, perhaps, you know, in the end, they had to go back without an agreement. They had to admit defeat. In the end, they did, in the February and March of 85. Should that have been a wiser decision to do it earlier? And would it have saved a lot of the hardship? I'm just saying, those are the questions that are being asked now as we go into the anniversary year. But you're quite right, Tony. Among Arthur Scargill's firmest supporters, there's no doubt they believe that they pulled off a victory. They withstood the full forces of Mrs. Thatcher for a full year, and they believed that was a fantastic achievement, and it demonstrated the strength and the unity of workers. But well, in reality, you have to look at the other side of the coin.
Yes, well, 40 years on, it does look as if this was really the spearhead of a campaign to dismantle a lot of British industry. We've just had the Port Talbot Steelworks announced that now owned by a foreign owner, is being closed down. Well, steel and coal were the absolute bedrock of Britain's industrial manufacturing past, and it seems like that whole thing, would you agree, has been dismantled. I wonder why you think that's happened. Has the European Union and the EEC played a role in that? What's been going on over the last 40 years?
Well, what's been going on in the last 40 years is short-termism. You know, the steel industry hasn't invested in new kit in some of these new arc furnaces. They could have been installed years ago. We could have updated the equipment, but we've lacked an industrial strategy. Now, this applies particularly to the coal industry, because you wouldn't believe it. Here we are talking about the start of the anniversary year of the miners' strike, and in the news is the announcement that the government is going to build a new generation of gas-fired power stations. Now, that's come about because in the 80s, because of the strike, the government abandoned any further attempt to develop clean burning of coal. Now, then, the point was that in the early 80s, there were lots of schemes afoot to bring in a new generation of coal-fired power stations that would burn coal differently and that would be, you know, reducing the pollution level and reducing the carbon emissions, etc. Now, that was all abandoned. And, of course, then that was followed by the dash for gas in the 90s. That led to the mass closure of the collieries because there wasn't a new generation of coal-fired power stations coming along. And hey-ho, here we are in 2024, 40 years later. The gas stations that were built in the 90s are now needing replacement, and the government knows that if, you know, there's a danger, unless we have new gas-fired power stations built and on standby, we could see the lights going out. And what an echo that is of the failure to think long-term about the fact that beneath us, as Arthur Scargill always said, you know, there's enough coal, if it was burned properly and cleanly, to keep Britain powered and the lights on for a century or more.
But I mean, surely at the end of the day, this dismantlement of coal and steel in Britain, I mean, this is one of the reasons the very first vestiges of the EEC were put together, the European Coal and Steel Community, back in the 1950s. It does rather denude us as a nation. And in fact, some have even said that without coal and steel, and particularly coking coal to make new steel in the big steel plants that we had mostly in the north of England, but obviously Port Talbot was one of them, you can't actually be a country because you can't defend yourself. You can't fight a war.
No, I agree entirely. We've sold the pass. And of course, that's why it's such a tragedy for the workers involved. I mean, if you just spin back to the 1980s, in 1984, the highest average manual earnings for workers, were in the Doncaster region because it was the centre of the coal field and it had all the industries that supported coal. Now, of course, it's a centre of deprivation. And we've just lost generations of well-paid manual earnings jobs in industry. And they've gone. And it's a terrible tragedy. And, you know, where the coal fields were once, we've now got warehouses where people are on short-term contracts and 0 hours and you name it.
It's no coincidence, is it, that Rochdale is where George Galloway, the former Labour MP, has been so successful in the last few weeks. It seems that that many would say the Labour Party's lost its way. It's become a neoliberal sort of shadow of the Conservative Party. Would you agree? Do you think people in the north of England agree?
Well, I mean, there are no doubts that there are special factors that have applied in the Rochdale by-election. You know, the fact that Labour didn't put up a candidate and that George Galloway was able to exploit this this growing tension within the Muslim community, many of whom are in constituencies like Rochdale. So, you know, it was a classic own goal by the Labour Party. But I agree with you; it does point to wider failures. And that's why, of course, you know, when Labour pulled the plug on the 28 billion that they were going to invest in green energy, yes, they say they're going to do something, but, you know, the target isn't there anymore. That was why it was such a terrible, terrible shame. And it, as I said, it takes me back to the succession of failures over the coal industry. You asked me earlier, what were my memories? Well, the most significant memory for the coal industry was in the early 90s, because we used to have lots of conversations with the coal board, and they said, look, we can see the writing is on the wall. We can't persuade the government anymore to invest in a new generation of clean burn coal-fired power stations. We've got the coal, but we need the new kit. And they wouldn't give the loan guarantees for it. And Michael Heseltine said, no, we'll get a quicker return, a faster return, i.e. a quicker buck, if we go for gas-fired stations and use up North Sea gas, which is exactly what they did. So it was sort of classic short-termism. And then in 1992, they went ahead with it. And just think of this statistic. Michael Heseltine was very proud of the fact, and he told me this, and he's repeated this to me, that look, he said, I negotiated £1 billion in 1992 for the redundancy payments at the 32 pits that we closed in 1992. That was the year of the mass pit closures. And he said, look, he said, I knew at the time that when it came to it, once we put the offer on the table to men at the pits, there would be a majority to take the money. And they took the redundancy payments. And that's classic short-termism, isn't it? And then you see, John Major now reflects, he was up in the northeast last year, and he said, the northeast of England, he said, my biggest regret is that in the 1992, when we closed all those pits, we didn't do enough to provide a new generation of jobs. And he was looking at the desolation there is in these former mining communities. And I just thought, well, John Major, you know, you signed the cheque for the £1 billion, the short-term payoff, the redundo payments that people accepted. Of course, they took the money, but there was nothing in its place.
No. And maybe that money could have been spent on the new generation of, at least trying out the new generation of coal-fired power stations with this carbon capture. But look, Nick, I think when people think of the miners' strike, they think of these mass pickets with thousands of miners trying to stop vehicles using places. Can you, I mean, I imagine you covered some of that. I'm sure you did. Can you just tell us what was going on there? People have seen the pictures, but what was the kind of reasoning behind these mass pickets and these blockades?
Well, the whole reasoning behind it was this, that you see, in 1972, when there was a miners' strike, and there were quite a lot of miners' strikes in the early 70s, Arthur Scargill, for the first time, because they were trying to stop the coke and the coal leaving the coke works, and the coal leaving the pits because the men were on strike, they were stopping the movement of coal and coke, because, of course, they believed that would close down industry and they'd win the strike. Well, in 1972, there was the famous dispute at the Saltleygate Coke Works, and what happened there was that Arthur Scargill, or a young activist in his union then, organised flying pickets from Yorkshire. They came down, and they had this mass protest outside the Saltley gates, and the cops, the police, had to hand over the megaphone to Scargill and said, "Mr. Scargill, we're going to close the gates. We're going to stop the place. Tell everybody to go home." A massive win, a setback for the Conservatives. Ted Heath had to, you see, agree to a 27% pay rise, a 27% pay rise, to buy the miners off that year. That was 72. Of course, it came on to 74 when he had yet another strike. But the key point to remember is that, you see, Arthur Scargill had tasted power. That was his most impressive victory. And he was convinced, you see, that industrial force could do it again. And that was why he picked on Orgreave. He thought that if we could stop the Orgreave coke works supplying, continuing to supply coking coal to the steelworks, especially at Scunthorpe, it would be such a setback for the government that it would, prove the critical moment in the strike. It didn't happen because, of course, the police had organised this unprecedented a number of police officers. 6,000 police officers had been organised from across the country to defend the Orgreave works. And we had, of course, what happened, the Battle of Orgreave. So I think the belief was, and the belief always was, Mr. Scargill, was that, brute industrial force could do it, and that by sending pickets to stop the coal movement, you could win the strike. I fear that what happened was that the police eventually got control of the situation by the summer of 84. And that's why I think it just became a waiting game until could the miners be starved back to work? And of course, Mrs. Thatcher claimed that half of them, she claimed that half of them were back at work by the end of February 85, and she declared victory. And that's when the union had to throw in the towel and agreed to go back to work, having won nothing. And of course, it was that terrible moment for the trade union movement. Here were the shocked troops of the trade union movement having been defeated in this way. And the lesson today is, of course, that no union could possibly call out its members on an indefinite all-out strike. The most we get is what, 2 or 3 days strike action? And that has to be pretty tightly organised. You just don't get the all-out strikes, because the people of today, the workers of today, just cannot afford to do that.
No, and it's, I think, fascinating to hear about Scargill and his flying pickets. It's almost as if he was running a military operation with his air mobile battalions, you know. So this sort of thing, I suppose, it really was a battle. But look, what about today? Because we've got an almost complete turnaround has gone on, because we had enormous popular support, particularly in the north of England and Wales, for the miners. Massive of things like, I suppose you would say, local food banks and this kind of thing, local people collecting for them, etc. And yet now the demonstrations are against coal. It's almost as if everything's been turned on its head with these people like Extinction Rebellion around. What they seem to be saying is coal is bad, and it's almost as if the whole thing has been turned on its head with these new kind of, well, they would call themselves anyway, environmentalists.
Yes, they have turned it on its head. But as I said, the tragedy was that we were leading the world in the development of clean burning of coal. It is possible to burn it in a much more environmentally friendly way. And of course, we gave up our world lead in that, as we've chucked away so many other things. And that, to me, was the biggest tragedy. There was a what was called a fluidized bed way of burning coal. I can't quite imagine it, but as a sort of, it was a way of burning coal without the fumes and capturing the carbon. And, you know, that could have been the way future. That could have been the way forward. But of course, as we've seen around the world, you know, the biggest environmental disasters are in places like India and China, where they're burning coal in power stations and just spewing out carbon and, and pollution. And there's no control on it. And that seems to me a dreadful tragedy, you know, that here was Britain in a place, in a position in the 80s to have led the way, and we didn't. And, you know, we're seeing the echo of it today with the fact that they're going to have to rush out the construction of new gas-fired power stations using imported gas, of course. And here we are, as you rightly said, the British steel industry about to lose its last full-blown steel furnaces. So, you know, it's a year, this year, when I think the echoes of some of the mistakes of the past are going to come and hit us right in the face.
What do you make of the scientific debates about climate science? The New Green Deal is a book just out by Jeremy Rifkin in the States. He says that this whole idea of a zero carbon economy is an academic fantasy and nothing more.
I would have to pass on that, but I would have to say immediately that, I mean, I do think there's no doubt about it that we in this country are blessed with lots of forms of, whether it's hydroelectric power, whether it's, the wind turbines. I mean, we do have potentially lots of sources for green energy. And I mean, I look on the optimistic side. I think that, the naysayers, should be swept aside on this one. I think we should go full blast to see if we can, in fact, generate electricity in that clean way. Of course, we've got a new generation of nuclear power stations coming on as well. So, I mean, clearly, it's got to be a mixed portfolio. So I would say that anybody who's knocking the idea that, we can produce electricity in an environmentally friendly way, I think they're wrong. I think we can, and I think that's the way forward.
Nuclear, environmental, this is one of the things that amazes me. The Scottish Greens even saying, yes, we should extend the life of the nuclear power stations. And even the Greens now seem to be pro-nuclear, Nick.
Yes, because, of course, they see that it still plays this vital part. That, we can't rely on the wind and we can't rely on the sun for solar panels, can we? We have to have a mix, but there's no doubt about it. We could rely, for example, on the tides in the Bristol Channel, couldn't we? What
we
about that?
We certainly could, yeah.
But would the environmentalists allow it? I mean, would they allow the upper reaches of the Severn Estuary to become sort of
tidal
lagoon?
Well, this is my point, really, is that these debates seem to be about control of energy and its generation, nothing really to do with the environment anymore. I mean, it's quite certain, it's very, very simple to have these sorts of tidal generation, and much cheaper too, and more reliable, many would say. But anyway, look. Finally, Arthur Scargill today has been criticised in the Doncaster Free Press for calling Israel a fascist state in his Doncaster Miners Parade speech. The veteran trade union leader Arthur Scargill came under fire for calling Israel a fascist state during a speech marking the 40th anniversary of the miners' strike in Doncaster at the weekend. So do you think the naysayers of Scargill are right, that he's a bit of a maverick that should be ignored?
Well, he's a maverick. Unfortunately, you can't ignore him because, he knows he's going along with a tide of criticism of the Israeli state. You've only got to see the success of George Galloway. This is a rising tide in their favour. Of course, it takes me back to the middle of the miners' strike because, of course, then Scargill was being very critical of the Polish solidarity, the freedom movement, Solidarnosc. And he was creating the same sort of waves. He was very critical of Solidarnosc because he was prepared to support the communist governments of the Eastern Bloc, people to whom he had a lot of help during the strike. So Scargill is going to continue to be his own man, and he's going to continue to say what he wants to say. And I think he's just as capable now of creating headlines as he was back in 1984. That's for sure. I mean, that was why I would have to say, I attended so many events of Scargill, and that's what my takeaway from Scargill is, that when you're in the presence of people who can command an audience and who can get people, standing up and cheering, and who can call on the sort of loyalty that he got during the miners' strike, well, those are exceptional leaders. Whether you agree with them or not, they are exceptional people, and he is still an exceptional person. And
amazing
was.
Really, yeah, he's so articulate, and he's still around. Amazing. Nick,
at 86.
What about you? Can people follow you on social media? Have you got books out?
Yes, I have my own blog called nicholasjones.org.uk, where I've got loads and loads of stuff that I've been writing about the miners' strike and the anniversary, the celebrations of the 40th anniversary. Because what I've tried to do is look behind. We've seen these documentary programs, which have been so good because they've given the miners the right of reply. So talking heads like myself, who covered the strike, we've had to take a back seat. And many of the BBC's critics would say, about time to, go to the back of the room, Nick. I've been in the back of the room, but I've still been writing because I still think there are a lot of untold stories about the miners' strike. And just think of this one. We've got something called the Undercover Police Inquiry, which starts again in July of this year. And they are looking at undercover police operations from 1983 onwards, which gets us right into the middle of the miners' strike. And if you look at some of these documentaries and hear some of them, they're all talking about the fact that they believed that Mrs. Thatcher had ordered the police and MI5 and everybody else to be tapping the phones of minors and that it wouldn't be acceptable today. Certainly Arthur Scargill has always said that he was convinced his phone was tapped. So you can see that for oldies like myself, we're still sitting on the edge of our seats because who knows what revelations we're going to get in 2024 about what happened in 1984.
Well, I mean, I know Margaret Thatcher characterised the miners, particularly Scargill, as the enemy within. It sounds as if the boot was on the other foot, that the enemy within was infiltrating the miners as part of the secret state.
That's right. And, you know, were journalists like myself monitored? We just don't know. These are very significant questions that remain to be asked. I mean, I know that a number of journalists are working on this because, you know, this is one of the areas where we've yet to learn the truth of what was going on. To what extent was there surveillance by the state? Now, we've had some references to it. By cabinet secretaries who've said, and they've had to justify the fact that there have been some references, and they've said that, of course, it was justified because the miners' leader, Arthur Scargill, and his colleagues were seeking money from foreign unions. You remember the fuss about the miners' union. Actually, representative went to see Colonel Gaddafi in Libya at the height of the strike. There were also money that was coming in from mining federations in the communist bloc. And the belief of the government was that this was a threat to national security, and therefore that justified the telephone tapping that was undertaken. But what we don't know the answer to is how far down the chain did that go? Because in these documentary programs that have been coming out, because it's just the men, mainly the men and their families talking, and they're all saying repeatedly, you know, that they believe the police knew exactly where they were going to be, where and when, and they believe and still believe that their phones were tapped and that there was a degree of surveillance that if it was ever publicly acknowledged, I think would shock the country.
Yeah, well, there is one little anecdote that I've heard, and I'm not sure if you can corroborate it or not, that when, once the pits were closed, there was a deliberate attempt to infill them with rubble of various sorts to make it very, very difficult for them to be reopened, even if that was just deemed necessary.
Yes, I mean, there's no doubt at all that they were made safe, i.e. that they were access was prevented. You would need to dig a new shaft to be able to get to them. And of course, many of those pits have actually been built on. I mean, up and down the country, you know, there are pictures of especially warehouses which have been built on the sites of the pits. So this is the point. You would have to build and start again with deep mine coaling if it was ever agreed to go ahead. I mean, there is this great debate up just north of the Lake District, you know, as to whether or not they're going to have a new coking mine up there. So, I mean, the debates go on, but you're quite right. I mean, the point is that to start again with the coal industry, we would need to begin right from the beginning and build new mines and new shafts. And that would be a phenomenally expensive operation.
Yeah, and if people want to follow this up and go and find out a bit about the coal industry as it was, there is a fantastic museum here in near Blaenafon in South Wales called Big Pit, where they'll even take you down an old coal mine.
That's right.
And I believe there's also a place near Wakefield.
Yes, it's called the National Mining Museum, and they too have the opportunity to go underground. That's the National Mining Museum near Wakefield.
And what about, have you written about this? Have you got books out, that sort of thing, Nick?
Well, I mean, I do write quite a bit. I've written quite a few books about this whole area. A lot of them have been published by a group called the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom. We've done numerous books on the miners' strike, especially, which was most important, was when we looked back at the cabinet records that were published under the rules that, you know, applied and still apply in many cases. A government's, a prime minister's records are published 30 years later under the 30-year rule. That's been shortened, but the point is that in 2014 and 2015, we got lots of Mrs. Thatcher's records coming through, and we could look through them. And
Ah.
my word, it was fascinating to
So
see
anyway, have you
the
got some titles
documentation.
for any listeners that are interested in getting hold of those books? What titles can you
Well,
name?
one of the titles is Settling Scores, which is all about the way in which it was pretty clear that what the government had been up to. That's Settling Scores. My own book is Strikes and the Media. I wrote that about the I wrote that in 1986, and that's all about the miners' strike. Another one is called Pit Props, and that's all about the international support that was given to the miners' union. So, and of course, if anybody wants to go on my own website and look under trade union reporting, that's nicholasjones.org.uk, you'll see I've got a whole section there on the stuff that I've written over the last 20 years. So, what I try to do is make anything that I've written available online, and you can just look it up, and people can email me a message if they disagree or agree or whatever.
This one of the most amazing tales you've just mentioned is this one of going to see Colonel Gaddafi, because of course, if you look at what's happened to Libya since David Cameron and the attack on Libya, the country is basically there's now even slave markets over in Libya. It was a very successful country, whether you like Gaddafi or not. There were It was a very, very low rate of child mortality. It was a prosperous place. They didn't have any debt with the IMF. What exactly was Scargill up to with Gaddafi? Because that, I mean, I look back on that and I think, well, maybe this was one of the reasons that he gave the government a good excuse to really pull out all the stops against him by going to see Gaddafi. So what happened there?
Well, what happened was that there was no doubt that there was a lot of international support for the miners' union, and they were going where they could. I mean, they even went to Afghanistan, and Afghanistan miners gave them a shipload of raisins or sultanas or something or other, which they could sell in on the English market, and they could get the money from the sultanas. Now, then, what happened with Gaddafi was that they heard that he was prepared to support and give support, financial support, to the miners' union. And the chief executive of the union went out, Roger Windsor, went out to Libya and met Gaddafi. Now, again, I've just explained, we as old journalists who covered that, what we're waiting is we're waiting to see how these things were found out. Well, who tipped off whom about Roger Windsor's movements? Clearly, there was and must have been a degree of telephone tapping, because the Sunday Times was in the right spot at the right moment to get the right photograph when Roger Windsor landed at Frankfurt, having come back from Libya. So, all I think one can say about episodes like that is that we don't know the full story, and that's why I think it's right. The journalists who were there continue beavering away, as I am and as I try to expose exactly what went on.
Brilliant, Nick. Well, anyway, just remind us of your website one more time, please.
Yep, nicholasjones.org.uk, and it's a site there with all my stories and my reflections just recently on the miners' strike. And there's a very telling piece which I wrote, which was my own soul searching. It's all about my own soul searching about how the reporters covered the strike 40 years ago.
So, Nicholas Jones, old school BBC to the very core. Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, bye-bye.